tip today in association with Slattery's of Pecan, your main Peugeot dealer for over 50 years in the Premier County. Slattery'sGarage.ie.
Karina Mockett, Pats, and welcome back to the second hour of Tip Today. One of our listeners on to say, I worked hard all of my life, reared three boys, put them through college, and it's sickening to see how much the farmers get, and they're always cribbing. One of my sons can't get a house. He's paying €1,400 a month in rent and will probably never get a house. Nobody cares about the ordinary working person. They get no help from anybody. Farmers always get whatever they want when they crib. Farmers always have the best of machines and equipment. The young people of Ireland need to take to the streets like farmers did, and they might be treated better. This is one of our listeners on 083 311 3311. Now, Clash of the Clans is a story that traces the emergence of the Irish Mafia from the streets of Dublin to the highest echelons of global organised crime and right into the heart, in fact, of professional boxing as well. When a weigh-in turns into a gangland bloodbath, the tables begin to turn on the powerful Kinahan organised crime group. Best-selling author and award-winning crime journalist Nicola Tallant joins me now. Nicola, good morning to you.
Good morning, Fran.
And congratulations on the book. It's a marvellous read indeed, and it's rather different as well, because the perspective in the book really works. You've written yourself into the story. Was that a deliberate ploy to make it different to other books of its type?
Yeah, I suppose it was. I know people complain sometimes that gangland books are just full of, you know, names and details and facts and figures. And I can find that a little bit myself sometimes. You can, if you switch off, you're lost, you know.
Yeah.
So I sort of decided to put a little bit of my own adventures, shall we say, into it. There also seems to be this fascination on how the job is done, crime journalism, and how you actually go about trying to find out details about a mafia. So, I sort of thought I'd merge the two, and as such, it's nearly my own journey of discovery to what they are, how they emerged, and how they have infiltrated boxing to such an extent.
It's incredible. In the first chapter, you're in the airport to head off to Spain. This was the day after Gary Hutch was murdered. Was it instinct on your behalf? I'm trying to work this out. You ended up locking eyes with Daniel Kinahan, who was travelling as well. He was in the airport. Was it instinct that made you sort of discover that he was there in the distance somewhere and you locked eyes with him?
I had a couple of kind of strange experiences, and I'm still, the jury's out with myself whether or not it's just that you're operating in a heightened sense of awareness about what's around you when you're working in crime journalism, or if I do have a little bit of something instinctual. But I've often found myself just being aware that there's somebody in my presence that, you know, and in circumstances where, you know, it shouldn't be, like, okay, that day I was heading out to cover a murder, so it was slightly different. But in other social occasions, sometimes I found myself just feeling uneasy and realising that there's somebody, and sure enough, it turns out to be such. Maybe I was the sixth child or something like that.
Yes, but also I presume it's a self-protection in some way, because, I mean, you know, you're living under the shadow, I suppose, like all crime journalists, of what happened to Veronica, and you have to have that sort of consciousness.
Look, I think that's probably exactly what it is, to be fair. Like, all crime journalists really do operate on a slightly heightened sense, you know. You have to be constantly aware, always thinking ahead. It actually sort of reminded me of when we were all hit by COVID, and all of a sudden you have to just, you get used to it. You just have to make everything, you're kind of making a decision in everything you do, or you're just weighing up the risks. You don't even realise you're doing it anymore, you know, whether you're going to go into nightclubs or you're not or whatever. So it's a little bit like that, really. I think you're just constantly weighing up the risks and what you do. And unfortunately for poor Veronica, her death, I think, probably changed the job immensely, and the rest of us have worked on the basis that anything is possible ever since, you know.
And this brought up a discussion we had about your book and you and people in your profession, and what we were wondering was, where do you get that courage from? Because, I mean, I wouldn't have that, certainly, Nicola. There's no way would I want to mix with these guys, you know.
Well, I mean, like, I wouldn't be kind of mixing with them on a constant basis or anything like that. I mean, look, the criminal underworld is as full of different and interesting people as the normal world is. And I've met some really sound people there and, you know, people who are in it for all sorts of reasons. People go into it for various reasons. There's obviously clearly something seriously psychologically wrong with somebody who can order a murder like they're ordering a pizza. But they're just not all like that. Do you know what I mean? So there's a lot of actually quite decent people that
are... Is this the ordinary decent criminal that we hear about?
There's also people who've just kind of gone in and they can't get out. It's very difficult to get back out. You know, so there's all sorts of people. So you meet all sorts of people in it. And I do think that the job is no different, really, to people who work, like, in the guards or in the prison service or sometimes even in the ambulance service. And down in the courts, if you go down to the courts, you'll see some of the lawyers, the barristers, the judges, all of those people are mixing constantly with people who are criminals, who essentially have, you know, what we would consider a lower moral standard than the rest of us. So it just is a job, really. You know, in the end of the day, it's a job. And you get used to anything, maybe. I suppose if I was brought back and asked, would I like to be doing it? You know, I mightn't have. If you probably know what you're going into, ultimately, maybe I would have thought twice. I would have gone, started writing about fashion, maybe.
Would you?
I don't know.
You give us some of the history of the Hutch Kinahan gangs, and the Hutch one is interesting because it goes back to the flats, I suppose, inner city Dublin and that. But Christy Kinahan was a different ballgame.
Oh, he was. I mean, he is really a fascinating character in all of it. There's many fascinating characters in it, really, but he particularly, like, he actually, despite what you often hear, he wasn't from Oliver Bond or anywhere like it. He grew up in middle-class Dublin. I've seen the house where he grew up. It's a beautiful period red brick house. His mother ran a B&B from it. It was a very substantial property. His father was a taxi driver on the Gresham rank, very respectable occupation. He had three sisters who adored him, all of which who have gone into, you know, very good jobs. They were all educated. He was somebody who was good-looking. He was an only boy in the house. He was loved and adored. And he was one of these people that was good at everything he put his hand to. Do you know somebody who's good at sport, intelligent, anything? He could have done absolutely anything. And I'd say, had he not got into the drugs business, we'd be possibly talking about him because he was head of a Google or a Facebook or something like that.
The Kinahans, they moved quite a lot ahead of the Hutches. And do you put that down to the fact that Christy had such a business head and he looked at it almost like a corporation?
Yeah, he was very ambitious. So he supposed, really, the Hutch, a lot of Hutch side and certainly the previous generation, which would have been Jerry, the Monk Hutch and stuff, like, they would always have gone into criminality. All of those kind of, like, even the Gilligans and all from Ballyfermot, they all went in because they were poor, because they were hungry. Like, they went in as children to feed themselves. And all the employment that their parents and their grandparents would have had was gone. You know, it was a thing of the past. And all of a sudden, they were staring down the abyss of just this complete disparity with the rest of the city. I mean, they were poor. They were in and out of borstals. They were robbing. And then they were developing this hatred to normal society, ordered society and the guards. You know, there were different days back then as well where kids would have been beaten before they were brought to the court.
Yeah.
You know, all that sort of thing went on. So that just developed this criminality. And then, obviously, the generations that followed weren't bothered going into armed robberies and kidnappings and stuff. They were too high risk for them. And there was drugs. And it was the easiest way to make money. So that was just a no-brainer. And we have, as a society, really created breeding grounds for these gangs and for these, you know, young people to choose a life of crime.
The feud between them, I'm not quite clear. I mean, you go into it in the book, but why did that feud develop? It was the second generation largely that perpetrated it, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, there's a particularly interesting time period of between about 2012 and 2014, say. And at that 2010, Operation Shovel happened in Spain and the Kinahan mob was shut down. I mean, the Spanish police issued press releases, you know, had press conferences and said the Irish Mafia was no more. They'd been shut down. But actually, that operation was a failure for many reasons. By 2012, the Kinahan mob were back in business and Daniel Kinahan is beginning to take over from the father. The father has one more stint to do in jail and I think he just gets fed up because he's in and out of jail, actually, Christy Kinahan Sr., for most of his life. And he decides he wants to pull away, take his millions and hand over the reins to the son. So around that time as well, you're getting a merging of mobs in Europe. You have a cocaine boom. You have all the gangs using these encrypted phones, which the police authorities have no way of getting into, you know, for another few years. But they are actually operating a business the same way you or I could. Nobody can hear what they're doing. Mm. They're able to do their business quite happily on their mobiles. And you have this kind of perfect storm, a cocaine gold rush and the merging of the mobs. And I do think that, Daniel Kinahan became something bigger than his pal, who was Gary Hutch. I think he was always going to be bigger than him. And I think he sort of left him behind. And probably that created this sort of sense of jealousies. There was supposed to be money owed. There was touting. There was all sorts of allegations. I think really, and the way I try to do it in the book is, you never really get the full truth. The truth always lies somewhere in the middle, because every bit of information you get out of that criminal underworld is loaded, and it is given to you for a reason. And, you know, there's always something behind it. Each side has something to say. It's a little bit probably like a divorce, you know, in a warring couple.
Yes.
That the truth or whatever
is
lies
in between and some, in some
exactly.
way. The other huge aspect of the book, and it's absolutely fascinating, is boxing's dirty secrets. But I didn't realise it was so recent that there was an involvement with it. I think, was it 2013 that Kinahan began to get involved with the boxing?
Well, he set up MGM Gym in Marbella with his pal Matthew Macklin in 2012. He initially stayed in the background, but sort of got a bit of confidence and started coming out to social occasions and putting himself forward as the manager of the boxers. There's a totally documented from 2013 onwards. He's managing some very serious boxers who've been signed up to it. By 2016, when the Regency happens and really the focus comes on boxing, because the big shootout happens at a boxing weigh-in. In the aftermath, he stays very much, you know, it's his company. And then I think he realises that he has become a toxic figure within it. And if this business is to continue to grow and succeed, he needs to take a step back. So we're told that the club is sold out to a businesswoman and that he's no more anything to do with it. But then over the preceding years, as you know, he kind of comes in and out from the shadows. And obviously, most recently, Tyson Fury famously calls him out on a selfie video, which went viral around the world.
It's interesting. The rumours went around that time of the killing of David Byrne. Rumours went around about you that you had some information, some prior information that this was going to go down, that you held back that information so you could get a photo shoot and so you could get the scoop on this.
Well, that narrative developed around that time on these anonymous social media sites. And it wasn't just me. It was the media were supposed to be working in cahoots with the Hutch gang and with the police. And, you know, you may have seen over the years this sort of narrative has developed mainly on anonymous sites. But in more recent years, Kinahan himself has released a little movie and a song written by a rapper, a well-known rapper. And all that narrative is in it. And Kinahan has, you know, put that forward. He believes that everybody, including the then Taoiseach Enda Kenny, was working to have him killed. And, you know, a ludicrous conspiracy theory beyond belief. And I think a little bit of an insight into the mind. But nonetheless, he's a very manipulative character, Kinahan. And he has manipulated people along the way. And he does get people to do his dirty work for him. I mean, His partner Thomas Bomber Cabna, who is convicted before the courts in the UK for major drug dealing and money laundering offences, you know, he has kind of his career has ended because he took up the mantle for Kinahan. As Kinahan took off to Dubai, he sort of took on the role of avenging the attempt on his life. So, you know, he is somebody who seems to be able to convince people of these tall tales that he tells. But yeah, that narrative took off within the criminal underworld, and many people believe it.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. It's a wonderful read. Could I leave on probably the lighter note in the book, which is, and I love this, you posing as a drug dealer along with your photographer, because you wanted to have a look at the kind of opulent life that these people live. You visited an apartment. Would you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, Christy Kinahan, when he was arrested in 2010, was living in a beautiful apartment complex in Estepona. And he lived there with his young family. Now, when I was out investigating around 2013, they were back in business, just to try and get a sense of where this guy had come from. Because the last we knew of him in Ireland, he was before the courts, pleading poverty to a judge and saying he was a drug addict who wanted help, had got a free education in the Irish Prison Service, which he then used to develop all his business in Spain, his drug business. So we just kind of wanted to get an idea of the kind of opulence they lived in. So it was trying to set up a viewing of a property without having an address in Spain and sort of just floating to the country. It seemed to me that the best thing to do was to try and pretend to be a drug dealer because they're the only people who have the money. So it worked. So along we went and we were shown a number of apartments, including one right beside Kinahan's, which was a replica. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, it was like something off the television, really. It was absolutely opulent. There must have been about five kitchens in it, outdoor kitchens, indoor kitchens, kitchens for, you know, staff, kitchens for the people who live there. The bathroom was like a swimming pool with a big plasma screen television. I mean, it was just stunning. And that's the kind of wealth, that's drug money for you.
Brings
you back to
and
the
that was worth about a million for that apartment, was it?
Yeah, but that was during the crash.
Right.
So
you
know,
can imagine what it's worth now.
Yeah.
Isn't it just a great... It's a wonderful read, Nicola, and congratulations to you on it. Just finally, where is the story going from here, do you think?
Well, I mean, look, this book is really about the rise of the Irish narcos, and maybe the next one will be about their fall, because the story at this point is you have 60 people behind bars here in Ireland, associates with the Kinahan Mafia. They've been all but shut down in this country and in the UK. The guards are on to, the guards and police of Europe are on to the final phase of the takedown of them, which will be the directorship, the CEOs, which will include Daniel Kinahan in Dubai.
Mm.
And there's an inevitability to all these mafias and how they, you know, how they end up, because none of them tend to really go off into the sunset to nice retirement, but certainly very few.
Of course. But was it Larry Dunn who said, wait till you see the next generation? I mean, what are you seeing coming up on the streets now? Are you seeing the next generation of this in some way?
Well, this is it. I mean, we're on to generation probably three or four now at this stage at the drugs. And it's very sad. I just think it's very sad when you see kids that, you know, we can't just blame the underworld first. We have to take on responsibility ourselves, because nothing has changed and we're still seeing rafts of kids believing that this is the only choice they have to go into crime.
It's amazing. Nicola, a real pleasure, and as I say, we highly recommend the book. It's called Clash of the Clans. Thanks for talking to me today, Nicola.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. You know, Nicola Tallant, award-winning author there and journalist. 1800 938 007.
Tip FM's Tip Today with Fran Curry. In association with Slattery's of Pecan, Tipperary's main Peugeot dealer. Slattery's Garage Pecan, the name you can trust for over 50 years in the Premier County. Slattery'sGarage.ie.